Martin Kaiser III has worked for decades developing electronic surveillance equipment for the FBI, CIA, and military intelligence. He discusses his work in Odyssey of an Eavesdropper, which he wrote with journalist Robert Stokes. It's published by Carroll and Graff, and I'm pleased that it has brought Martin Kaiser to my show today. Hi.
Hi.
How much privacy do Americans really have today? Were you surprised by the last week by the New York Times revelation that President Bush had secretly authorized the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans without court-approved warrants?
Two parts of that question. The first is we have absolutely no privacy at all. We haven't had some since probably, I would say, the late 70s and thereabouts, because that's when wiretaps really became a standard game, all connected worldwide by computers. As far as being surprised about Bush, you compare that with my experience with the FBI, and I wasn't the least bit surprised that he was doing that. I wasn't the least bit surprised that he misrepresented the American people, the situation in Iraq, and none of that surprises me because I'm used to that type of talk all the time.
Well, you said that we've had very little privacy since the early 70s, but weren't things tightened up in 1968 first when laws were changed, and then after Watergate when new rules were applied to government?
No, primarily because the number of companies that got into the business expanded at that point in time. And I'm talking about companies that built bugging equipment and wiretapping equipment and the amount of dollars that various government agencies were putting into development in those areas. So it didn't slow it down one iota.
There are 60 companies in the New York City area alone that are willing to sell and install listening devices, I understand. Now, let's talk about the NSA for a moment. Why did they have to bypass the warrant process? Hasn't it been fairly easy to get those warrants?
Actually, it has been very easy to get the warrants. And based on my experience, they wouldn't have had to work too hard at it because in various states throughout the nation, law enforcement people are allowed to wiretap or monitor for 90 days without warrant. So what they do when their 90 days are up, they simply call another agency and say, I'm going to bump it over to you. And they just keep bumping it around their whole country and still do the warrantless wiretaps and eavesdropping.
Despite that, yesterday the New York Times quoted Vice President Dick Cheney as saying that the president hadn't sought warrants as part of a broader effort to reassert powers of the presidency that he said had been dangerously eroded after Watergate and the Vietnam War.
Well, if you look at how Mr. Cheney obtained his fortunes, you view that with what's weird. It doesn't bring much credibility to Mr. Cheney, although he has none to start with.
Didn't you consult on the movie Enemy of the State about the NSA?
Yes. When Jerry Bruckheimer first called me, the process that unfolded was that two reporters from the Baltimore Sun paper wrote a 6-part Sunday magazine article about the NSA. And it was an extremely good article, and I was surprised to see the level of material that was exposed.
Because the NSA had, some people used to joke and say it stood for no such agency.
Yes,
it was that
right.
Secretive.
That's right. So Jerry Bruckheimer's people picked up on it, and they thought, well, here's an agency that hasn't been beaten up like the CIA and the FBI. Let's beat up on them for a while. So they sent their research people out to find somebody that could connect the NSA to the world, and they found my website and my story of how I exposed high-level FBI corruption was on there. So we combined the Baltimore Sun article with my story to create Enemy of the State.
Well, how much did you know about the NSA when you started working on that film?
NSA is really a collect. They're supposed to. Dictum, if you want to call it that, is supposed to monitor foreign communications, but it didn't take them long to get into monitoring communications in the United States because a lot of foreigners were calling here, and then people would call. If a foreigner called here and talked to somebody, that somebody would call somebody else in the United States, and that was caused to follow his telephone conversations. They have horrendous computers at NSA that store tons and tons of data, and it's not hard to get at it and to move it around and do anything you want to do with it. And you can come up with phony credentials. and basically get whatever you want from NSA. I don't know if you saw in the paper the other day, but they just arrested an employee from NSA. He had carried enough documents out of NSA to fill his whole kitchen. And these were top secret documents. So you say, what is this? This is supposed to be a secure agency.
Many people first became aware of how easy it is to eavesdrop when they saw Francis Ford Coppola's movie in 1974 called The Conversation. Wasn't Gene Hackman's character in that based on you and your experiences?
He was more or less based on, not necessarily me, but the persona of those that do eavesdropping. And I think that was mainly it. I had to teach him how to debug the phones and how to look for microphones in various places. And I told Bruckheimer and Tony Scott, the director of Enemy of the State, use that doggone parabolic microphone in Enemy of the State, and I'm going to wrap you over the head with it, because that is not the way to collect intelligence, and it's a very, very impractical way to collect intelligence.
So when you see spy films, sometimes you must cringe when you see the silly mistakes that people make.
Yeah. I was really surprised in Enemy of the State that they have this billion-dollar satellite floating around in orbit, and for those of us who can understand Morse code, it was sending out the two letters CQ, which means in ham radio talk, where am I? And if they can't figure out where a multi-billion-dollar satellite is, something's wrong.
From the conversation, I got the impression that this could be a very lonely job, being an electronic surveillance guru.
I certainly want to be one. My forte was the manufacture of it, and people would come to me and say, well, I'd like to have a bug in this table leg, or try putting one in that lamp over there. And I would actually build the hardware to do that and then pass it on to the person that did it. And I'd never really hear what happened to them unless it was top, high news.
Although you also built devices to find bugs, didn't you? The Washington, D.C. police used one of your devices to find the bugs that were hidden in the Watergate Hotel.
Yes. My equipment has shown up in all kinds of detections. It showed up in the Martin Luther King assassination. It's shown up. I mean, that's my positive stuff, not my countermeasure stuff. It's shown up everywhere, and I've enjoyed it all over the years. I was disappointed when the FBI drove me out of the business of making bugging equipment and bug detection, so now I make my living making bomb detection equipment.
Well, it's interesting that the FBI, you have this contentious relationship with the FBI, because there's a time when the FBI loved you, didn't they?
Oh,
you
yeah.
even met with J. Edgar Hoover at one point.
Yeah, that was during that era. I was able to walk into every single intelligence agency in the country, and they'd all wave their hand and say, hi, Marty, good to see you again. And I'd go in and listen to their problems, and within a week I'd have a finished product for them.
What was J. Edgar Hoover like? Was he receptive to what you had to offer him?
Yes, he was very receptive. And I always think of as my first meeting with him in the layout of his office with the legs sawn off of the sofa and his desk on a pedestal. So he looked down on you, and I solved that problem by sitting on the arm of the sofa and looking him straight in the eye, and I think he liked that. But you realize you were sitting there with a man who had enormous power, and I had absolutely no power. I was just a one-person company. So it was quite a contrast. But actually, it was a one-person company like myself that brought the whole organization down. So you never know where the power is.
At one time, you were the FBI's main supplier of electronic bugging equipment, and then that all change later. Can we hold off on that story until a little later in the discussion?
Sure.
My guest is Martin L. Kaiser III, who's written with the help of Robert S. Stokes, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper, My Life in Electronic Countermeasures and My Battle Against the FBI. It's published by Carol and Graf. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at wnyc.org. And a reminder that we will be keeping you up to date on the latest about the transit strike as the day ensues. So you said before that privacy in America pretty much is an illusion these days. We just think we have this fundamental right?
I would prefer to have us think like the Japanese. The Japanese recognize that they have no privacy, and they accept it as such. And everything you do in their society is based on the lack of privacy. And I don't know where we got this thing that everything is private, because if we stand on the street corner and listen to other people's conversations, they've lost their privacy, even though we're not going to do anything with it.
But they've given it up willingly. I think the fear most people have is that they are going to go to the library, take a book out, and discover that the government has now started a file on them, or already has a file on them for things that they thought were innocent.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people would assume that it's perfectly all right to do surveillance on possible terrorists, possible criminals, but they're afraid that now may wind up affecting them as well. Is that likely? Is the government likely to be spending any time thinking about Leonard Lopate?
They'll definitely be thinking about this one. When I received my FBI files as a result of the civil suit that was brought against me by these two FBI agents, I had a chance to look through 4,000 pages of documents, and I found FBI reports in there from times that agents had lunch with me. And you say, well, you know, why make an FBI report out of a lunch? Well, all of this goes to, well, you have to really go back to how Hoover started. He started as a card cataloger in the bowels of Congress, and he was cataloging books and events and everything, and suddenly he thought, well, I better start cataloging people. And that's how the FBI started, and look at what it grew into. So it's just data collection to the extreme, and that really troubles me, because once you get in there, you can't get out.
Congress just voted to extend the Patriot Act for 6 months. Do you think the Patriot Act has eroded the privacy of Americans as much as its critics claim?
Yes, I do. A patriot is one who defends the Constitution and Bill of Rights to the extreme. I mean, basically willing to give up his life for it. And the Patriot Act, in my opinion, takes everything away from us. We lose our right of free speech. We lose our right of free assembly. You know, and they're calling it something that it's not. It really should be an anti-Patriot Act.
Well, the president says that we've extended it 6 months, but the terrorists won't go away in 6 months.
No, they're not going to go away. And that was one of the things that disturbed me about 9/11, was we immediately attacked a variety of people. Osama bin Laden was one of them. But I didn't hear anybody asking, why did they do this? Why did they commit this absolutely horrible act? And I think, sad to say, it's what was that comment about, not Big Brother, but the enemy is ourselves. And I think if they had researched this, why people do these things, they would come right back to us. We just are not doing things properly.
The Patriot Act's authorization of sneak and peek searches has been particularly troubling to its critics. What are sneak and peek searches?
That's coming in your house and without proper legal authority and looking in your computer or looking in your dresser's drawers. Those are all sneak and peek, and it's something you shouldn't do. But now sneak and peek includes programs you can buy on the open market, on the web, that you can then send to your competitors and your girlfriends or whatever and monitor absolutely everything that's going on inside their computer.
And will I even know that this has been done to me?
No.
So nobody has to be notified that they've been searched?
No. Well, you certainly wouldn't want to notify your competitor that you put a program in to steal all his data.
So is this mostly a business thing?
No, it's a people thing. And they're inexpensive. You can buy them on the web for anywhere from $150 to $200 for these programs and just literally gain tremendous amounts of information.
Well, the reason I ask is you've said that the Patriot Act is diverting attention from the real problem, which is the private sector development of intrusive technology. And that's mostly stealing other people's trade secrets, isn't it?
Well, if you want to talk about stealing trade secrets, look at me. I developed three industries in my lifetime, and all three of them were stolen from me by the United States government. And
stolen? They didn't pay any money for them?
No. And this all is a mindset that had started to occur in the mid-60s, went through the racial strife we have in the Vietnam War, where all these government employees saw manufacturers like myself as rich people, and that we really should get into that business. So what they simply did was take your business away from you and left you. Well, in short, the free enterprise system went out the door.
So hasn't the government developed its own sophisticated information gathering tools, or is it just simply taking them from people in the private sector?
Taking them from people in the private sector.
Didn't Admiral John Poindexter develop a program called Total Information Awareness?
Well, like Al Gore invented the internet. my private joke is that Al Gore also invented the algorithm, which, of course, was invented back in biblical times.
Well, actually, that's a dance step, but that's another thing altogether. Yeah. Now, John Poindexter, many people will remember, was convicted for conspiracy and lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal. And then he came up with this TIA program, which Congress shut down because they said it was too intrusive. What was it all about?
Well, again, it's a matter of who wants to know what in Washington. You know, you go into the Watergate era, one side wanted to know the other. And it's all a tool. Washington is a strange place, and I'm glad you don't live too close to it because you really have a problem, like I do. So
there's also new programs like Matrix, which have nothing to do with the movie.
Right. Yeah, I was involved in that.
What is that involved?
Well, I was involved in Threat Matrix. Now, is there a new one called Matrix?
Yeah.
Well,
you've mentioned an airline passenger screening program called CAPS 2.
Right.
What is that
now,
about?
No, actually, CAPS 2, when we wrote the book, was an active program, and then Congress figured out that really was a tremendous invasion of privacy, so they've dropped it. So here I wrote the book with it in, and now it's out.
You mentioned that you've developed all of these tiny listening devices and equipment designed to find those devices. Can you tell us something about them? How small are the listening devices?
Listening devices are extremely small. They can be the size of a pea. But the problem is you have to power them somehow. And it's usually the battery that's the dead giveaway of these things. And the batteries can be found in any number of ways, both physical and electronically. So that's always the problem.
How do you get around that?
Well, you generate a little detector like they did in the Great Seal in the ambassador's office in Moscow, where you put a device in there that is actually powered by a microwave beam, and then you use the return information to extract the conversation. And that's being done on a regular basis throughout the United States as we speak.
And that was something that was developed by the Soviets?
That was developed by the Soviets.
They were pretty good at this stuff, weren't they?
They were very, very good. I had a friend that went to Russia recently, and he looked behind the table radio that was in his apartment, and there were two wires coming off the loudspeaker, which is the best microphone in the world. And they ran down the wall, and I'm sure somebody was listening to him.
Well, in your book, you describe two types of telephone attacks, the tap and the compromise. In the compromise, the phone is turned into a listening device by itself, so it's generating its own power, isn't it?
Yes, positively.
Is it that must make it very difficult to find?
Extremely difficult to find, especially in the days of fiber optics. Wires are replaced with fiber optics things, and the Israelis are making a telephone compromise device that is a fiber optic strand that's thinner than a human hair. And trying to find that, it's impossible.
What about with cell phones? Is that added to the complexity of all of this?
Yes, and of course everybody in the whole world monitoring cell phones. Anything that goes out in the airways can be demodulated and monitored. The big problem is who's going to listen to them all. That's.
Are people a little nervous around you, thinking that you might be recording their conversations?
No.
I mean, I'm worried about you planting a bug here, but we already have microphones, so it doesn't matter.
I'm a happy-go-lucky guy. I like life. I travel to the Cayman Islands quite a bit. I do a lot of scuba diving, and I enjoy what I do. I'm a human doing, not a human being.
Is this a profession that people go into by choice, or do you stumble into it?
You stumble in it. I stumbled into it because of my love of beer. And when I was doing industrial repair in Baltimore, I did all the steel mills and plastic companies and then started doing the breweries. And one day I went to American Brewery, and you have to drink all the beer before it hits the floor. So I got totally plastered, and I was driving around Baltimore. I saw this sign that said U.S. Army Intelligence. And I thought, well, I'll go in there and see what they have that's broken. And the next thing you know, I'm making all this stuff.
We will take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out what got you in trouble with the FBI and whether you're proud of being the inventor of devices like Scan 23, which were used during protests against the Vietnam War to allow police monitors to disrupt the protesters' CB radio communications on all 23 channels. My guest is Martin Kaiser III. He's written with journalist Robert Stokes, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper. It's published by Carol and Graf. Stay with us. We're back with Martin L. Kaiser III, who's written, with the help of Robert S. Stokes, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper, My Life in Electronic Countermeasures and My Battle Against the FBI. It's published by Carroll and Graff. You've said that your clients have included the FBI, the CIA, the DEA, Secret Service, Army, Navy, Air Force Intelligence, Intelligence Services in Egypt, Argentina, and Canada. Did you have to invent new things for each one of those clients?
Generally, the foreign clients ran behind the U.S. clients, so it was a case of playing make-up all with these foreign customers so I could use older technology to keep them on track. I generally found that the level of technology that foreign countries had was about, I'd say, 10 to 12 years behind what we had. And it was interesting.
Is the market bigger for bugs or for equipment to detect the bugs?
I haven't the slightest idea now. I've been driven out of that marketplace with an exclamation point.
But when you were doing it?
I was just a small guy in the overall picture. I was the most innovative guy. And when you see most of the bugs that are being manufactured today, they're basically carbon copies of stuff that I made years ago. You get companies with, in the case of one Florida company, had a budget of $100 million to get open its doors. They're generating a tremendous amount of equipment, and there's no way for me to determine how much they're actually making. And the FBI has all those figures, and they're certainly not going to give them to me.
Well, at one time, you were the FBI's major supplier of electronic bugging equipment, small business or
right,
not.
Right.
How did you run afoul of the FBI?
I had two investigators from the House Select Committee on Intelligence come to me. And built into the 1968 Omnibus Crime Bill, which is the bill that regulates bugging, was an automatic five-year review period. They were running 2 years behind, so it was 1975. And I said, well, here are my files. Just go through them, and anything you want to know, I'll answer the question. And they ran into a bunch of my invoices that were to U.S. Recording Company. And I said, they asked me, who is this U.S. Recording Company? I said, well, that's the FBI. It's their little front operation.
It was a fake company.
It was a fake company. Well, what I didn't realize, the U.S. Recording Company was owned personally by the high-level management of the FBI, and they were running small companies like mine through it, and out of the $25 million they ran through U.S. Recording Company, they personally pocketed $7.5 million. And with that money, they built a little country club in Western Maryland called the Blue Ridge Rod and Gun Club. And the FBI held me responsible rather than the investigators for the National Wiretap Commission, and I was easier to dump on. So they did. They really did. And it was very touchy, and it was a long-running attack that ran until 1978, where they were slowly – my business went to zero right after my testimony in 1975 – and they were nibbling away at me, trying to set me up in various ways. And I had written many letters to my congressmen and senators and the attorney general, and I said, tell them to stop this kind of stuff. And they wouldn't do it. And I said, okay, I'm going to bug you guys, and we're going to go to war. And that's exactly what I did.
Is that what got you in trouble? You were indicted for illegal wiretapping of two FBI agents.
It was interesting. I knew full well because I had found their wiretaps and their bugs before I put my own bug in. So I knew they were watching me, and I made painfully clear to them that I was well within the law that I did it when I did it. They alleged that I did it outside the law, and that was what my trial was all about. And I prevailed. I was right. I was within the law.
So you were acquitted. There was a civil suit.
Yes, the two agents that caused me to be indicted sued me for $22 million, claiming I caused them mental anguish. The one agent said I aggravated the sty in his eye, and the other agent said I aggravated his hemorrhoidal condition. So I turned around and sued the Bureau for libel and abuse of power, and $300,000, $350,000 later, I just had to walk away from it. I couldn't handle these guys. But one of the most interesting outcomes of this thing, even before I went through the criminal trial, I was able to obtain the names and addresses of all the grand jurors. And that was given to me because one of the FBI agents was in the grand jury room when I testified, and that is a violation of federal law. And so we had a special hearing. I would say he was there. He would say he was not there. So the only way to prove it is to bring in some grand jurors. But before we got to that stage, the judge whacked his gavel and said, "Mr. Kaiser, you're mistaken, honest or otherwise," and there went my list. But those grand jurors heard from me right after my trial, and they heard from me in a big way. And when the civil case occurred and I was given all my FBI files, there were all 24 of my original letters that I had sent to these grand jurors right on top of the pile. So they sent eight teams of agents out to get all my letters. I thought that was kind of interesting. It was a big honor in a way, roundabout way.
To think that they were devoting so much time and energy and expense to you. Yeah. But, of course, you had to devote a lot of expense as well.
Right. They didn't care about that.
This must have bankrupted you.
No. My wife keeps telling me, "You're smarter than they are." So I hope that's what kept me alive, because I had enough clout with other agencies that were not among this terrorist group of agencies, and I call them a terrorist group, because they terrorized me, as sure as my family. So I just played the game the way the game was supposed to be played.
Earlier in the show, you were rather critical of the Bush administration. Would you be if all of this hadn't happened? Because you were once part of that establishment, weren't you?
When I saw two FBI agents lying to the grand jury, lying before the court, and getting away with it with no problem at all, I assumed at that point in time that every single politician, every single government employee is just a liar. And they have to prove themselves to get out of that mindset that I have. I don't like it one iota. And the trouble is when you attack one agent like the FBI, you've attacked 15,000 agents, and they all turn on you.
So what is your business like now?
I'm still making bomb disposal equipment, because people need bomb disposal equipment, and they can do anything they want to with me. It's still needed equipment, and that's what I'm doing.
But I assume the FBI is not one of your clients.
No.
You've suggested that to ensure privacy today, a person would need to get off the grid entirely, close all the bank accounts, credit cards, telephone and cell phone service, and even shut off all utilities. Well, that's impossible.
That's impossible.
I mean, the gas company can... How much can the gas company know about me?
The gas company? You know everything. It depends. Like in my house, I have a radio meter, and who controls what's going out on that radio from the meter? So it's very easy to piggyback on top of that signal, put room conversation, telephone conversation on there. So you just don't know. I mean, the amount of technology it takes to do a countermeasure sweep is probably a thousand times more than building the bug and sticking it in place.
You probably have to destroy a Social Security card as well and avoid paying taxes, because I'm sure taxes reveal an awful lot about our lives.
Oh, yeah. And look at your Social Security card sometime. It'll say down the bottom of it, not to be used for identification. And now that's the key factor of life throughout the United States. You got to have a Social Security number.
We mentioned earlier that the Soviets came up with some great surveillance techniques, and you tell a very funny story about agents with induction coils in their shoes.
Yes, that was a good one. they knew that the Russians were passing information into their embassy because, I mean, that's just part of the spying game. And these Russian agents would go to one street corner time and time and time again. And the FBI was looking for radio frequency information, looking for lip readers, looking for everything. And it turned out the Russian agents had induction coils in the heels of their shoes, and there was an induction receiver in the sidewalk, and they would just turn on the tape recorder in their pocket and transmit the information through the sidewalk into the embassy.
So they but they couldn't move.
No, they couldn't move, but it could take a long time to smoke a cigarette.
They just had to stand there hoping not to shuffle their feet at all because they were sending all the stuff through the sidewalk.
Yeah, there was a fairly large area where it could be received, like a foot or two, so you could spin around in circles and things like that. But that was one of the more interesting ones. But the most interesting one was the one I found in the state attorney's office in Maryland, where they actually built a transformer in the cable itself, and that was extremely unique. A true technician's joy.
Martin L. Kaiser III was the technical advisor on films like The Conversation and Enemy of the State, the TV show Threat Matrix. He's president of Martin L. Kaiser Incorporated, an electronics company located in Cockeysville, Maryland, that specializes in the manufacture of eavesdropping devices and bomb detection and improvised explosive devices. We would hope a few of them would be in Iraq. His book, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper, is published by Carol and Graf. Thank you so much for being with us.